My friends, no story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself.
Will the audience please take the edge of their seat? This is the 18th episode of the History of Film, Heroines and Villains Every Week, Early U.S. Serial Film. Hello and welcome back to the History of Film. We have spent our last few episodes describing some of the factors that led to longer movies, eventually called feature-length films. These became the dominant form of cinematic presentation worldwide. We will return to that subject in the near future, as we begin what is likely to be multiple episodes talking about the early film industry of Italy and its super-spectacle long-form films. But there was another kind of movie that was growing up in the long shadow cast by the feature-length film. It was a kind of movie that told its story not in one long go, but over a long period of time. And it had an appropriate name. The serial. A serial is a movie that is designed to be part of a series that follows the same characters over the course of many episodes, often through a myriad of adventures and in the face of certain death. The serial film rose in prominence at the same time the repeating program of short films in the Nickelodeon was beginning to give way to the feature-length movie. That is to say, round about 1912 depending on how you count, but more on that later. This new film genre was a natural step for movies to take. Just as earlier films grew out of existing forms of entertainment such as vaudeville or stage plays, the serial film was not without precedent. Publishing print stories in serial format in newspapers or magazines began as early as the 1600s, and by the 1800s it would become the way that some of the most famous English-language writers would publish their work. What we now think of to be complete or whole novels by writers like Charles Dickens or George Eliot were originally published in sections that would keep readers buying magazines to see what happens next. Producers and exhibitors of film in the United States would adapt the rhetorical genre of the serial story into film for much the same reason. If the audience felt compelled to come back next week to see what happened to a beloved character, then that would guarantee another bucket of nickels which would enter the coffers of the exhibitors. That cash would then flow up the line all the way back to the production companies. But there was another important business reason producers were so eager to create serial movies. They were easy to advertise. In episodes 14 and 14A, we talked about how Nickelodeons, the dominant form of motion picture exhibition before about 1915, would change their movies regularly, often once a week or even once a day. They did this so that there would be plenty of novel entertainment for their precious repeat year-round customers. But this solution created a different problem. If the program of shows changed so frequently, how would one advertise specific films to attract new customers? Say, anyone who isn't already dedicated to going to the movies as a concept. One answer, which we have been getting at for several episodes now, was to make special films that were longer, more spectacular, and more expensive to make. Then charge more for them, show them for longer, and advertise the heck out of them. That was the feature-length film. Another solution was to make a series of films with the same characters, which would be around for months. An exhibitor could then advertise that series as a headline attraction and still change programs regularly. This, of course, was the subject of today's episode, the serial, and for many smaller producers or exhibitors who were unwilling or unable to make the switch to making or showing longer films, it proved to be, for a time, a lucrative alternative. We've actually seen some serial-esque movies already in earlier episodes of the show. D.W. Griffith directed his two-part film His Trust and His Trust Fulfilled back in 1911 in episode 16. And he directed a series of films co-starring Florence Lawrence called Mr. Jones from 1908 back in episode 16A. Both of these movies fit the category of serials in some ways, while missing the mark in others. The way they fit it is by technically being a series. But the His Trust films only have two parts, which is hardly how anyone off the street would define a series, and the Mr. Jones films lacked a continuous story, which would be one of the most important hallmarks of serial films in just a few years. We also briefly mentioned the 1909 film The Life of Moses, which was also kind of a serial and kind of not. I said in episode 15 that The Life of Moses was released one reel at a time, which would make it a serial, and that its release schedule was enforced by its production company, Vitagraph. That turns out to have been an oversimplification, as other writers than those I referenced in episode 15 have pointed out. Sheldon Hall and Steve Neal write in their book Epics, Spectacles, and Blockbusters: A Hollywood History that while advertising posters were made for each of the individual reels of The Life of Moses, suggesting it was designed to be shown serially, Vitagraph also encouraged exhibitors to show all five reels at once. So that one was both serial and a feature film, depending on how you saw it. All of the movies we just talked about were serial-esque, but are not usually grouped in with serials as the genre was about to exist. These earlier films kept audiences entertained, but serials proper were made to keep audiences gripping their seats and biting their nails. Serial movies accomplished this by showing crowded picture houses a charming protagonist who was out on a breathtaking adventure, threatened by cunning villains and deadly circumstances. I have an important quote about this, but it takes a second to set up. By the mid-1910s, some parts of the United States had film censorship laws, and Pennsylvania's head censor described serial films as a genre this way: "It's crime, violence, blood and thunder, and always obtruding and outstanding is the idea of sex." Can you believe he meant that to be a negative statement? Contemporary audiences didn't think it sounded too bad either. While lacking the prestige of movies being produced in the film-to-art movement and those like it, serials still brought in the crowds, and the crowds' wallets and purses. The serial would start to take shape with the Edison-produced What Happened to Mary, which began in 1912. The story follows a young country girl, Mary, as she moves to the big city and experiences the wonders of New York City while escaping the clutches of her scheming uncle. It's really hard to watch any of this, and at least some of the episodes are lost, but from their descriptions, we can already see some of what would become generic features of the American serial beginning to take shape. Mary is a young woman, as most of the protagonist of the early silent serials would be, and her adventures were published on screen and in print simultaneously. This symbiotic relationship between print and screen would be used to the advantage of both, and would set a pattern that would last through the decade of popular serial stories being published both in newspapers and in Nickelodeons. What Happened to Mary was a huge hit, and it put the serial format on the map. And whenever there's a huge hit, there are film producers ready to use that movie as a pattern to make their own. The serials that came after What Happened to Mary upped the ante and were more exciting, more daring, and more dangerous. The female protagonists at their centers became action heroes, climbing up and down buildings, jumping off moving trains, wrestling dastardly villains, solving puzzling mysteries, and shooting guns. They would sometimes be rescued by their boyfriends, but they would also get into and out of scrapes using their own wits and skills. The advent of these film heroines coincided with the burgeoning feminist movement in the United States, and, as writer Ben Singer puts it, a larger cultural fascination with the new woman, a revised model of femininity floated by the media at the time. Some of these series include The Girl Detective from 1915, The Million Dollar Mystery from 1914, and The Hazards of Helen, which ran in theaters for an astonishing 113 weekly episodes beginning in 1914. Despite any individualizing differences, the broad conventions of the serial were in place, and thanks to them, audiences could read and watch the charmingly similar experiences of their new favorite heroes in print and on screen at regular intervals. There were so many serials coming out between 1912 and 1919 that it's hard to express just how common they were, especially when you take into account how long they all ran. Just for fun, you can go look up List of Film Serials on Wikipedia and scroll through it. It really is impressive. And for every series of movies on that list, there was a star. Though there were many serial stars, sometimes called serial queens, There is one in particular that I would like to focus on right now. That person is Pearl White, and that is her real name. Pearl White was born on March 4, 1889, but didn't start acting in film until about 1910, working for American director Lois Weber, who is really important, and I promise we will talk about her in future episodes. Though White began work in the movies in 1910, she didn't become famous until about 1914, when she acted in the title role of The Perils of Pauline, produced by the American Pathé Company. In the Perils of Pauline films, White became the archetype of the serial queens we talked about earlier. She was known for her particularly daring stunts, which she claimed to do all herself despite some evidence to the contrary. The Perils of Pauline made the Pathé Company a pile of money, and so they launched White into serial after serial. These include The Exploits of Elaine, The New Exploits of Elaine, The Romance of Elaine, The Iron Claw, and Pearl of the Army, all before 1917. Because the Pathé Company was an octopus that had its tentacles all over the world, White became an internationally famous film star. In 1916, she was voted the most popular actor of all by Motion Picture Magazine. And even after losing her number one spot to Mary Pickford, she remained near the top of the popularity contest list for years. Pearl White is important to understanding the serial film from this period for a couple of reasons. First, she was the genre's most famous star, and she epitomized the action stardom that was at the center of the serial films. It takes some looking, but you can still find videos of her characters being sucked into deadly quicksand before pulling out her gun and shooting down a vine, using it to make her escape. Or you can see her wrestling and even fist-fighting an evil villain to achieve her heroic goals. As far as action set pieces are concerned, Pearl White was the bee's knees. Second, Pearl White, serial star, gave us very helpful language to describe the plots of early film serials. Ben Singer, who we referenced earlier, writes that the principal conflict of the serial was the back-and-forth contest between the villain and the heroine for herself, as she is in constant danger of kidnapping or murder by the villain. Their contest, however, could also be for the possession of an object that was important to the plot that week. A blueprint for a deadly weapon, a secret key, or strategic military documents. White, who was in these movies all the time, had a simpler name for all of them. The Weenie. The common pursuit of both hero and villain for the Weenie provided the basic structure for many serial plots, and even many movies made today. Think of the Tesseract from the first Avengers movie, the Death Star plans from Star Wars, or the doll from Wait Until Dark. All of these are excellent examples of weenies. For decades now, the object that gets the plot of a story moving has been referred to as a MacGuffin, but Pearl White coined a phrase for it which is perhaps just as good and even more expressive. There were other recurring themes or motifs besides the weenie that were prevalent in serial films. One of the most common was the heroine's relationship to her father, by which I mean the lack of one. Very commonly, the lead character's rich and powerful father would be kidnapped or assassinated at the beginning of the story, which puts her on the path to defeat the evil villains who did the dastardly deed and gain her rightful inheritance. This could be an overarching plot for the series, while A Battle for a Weenie could provide action for an individual episode. These old serials from the US were exciting, but not always imaginative. Pearl White and the serial genre prospered throughout the 1910s. By the 1920s, though, serials were in decline. Newspaper tie-ins with film serials gradually lost popularity, and serial films couldn't keep up with audience tastes, even if they did provide crime, violence, blood and thunder, and the outstanding idea of sex. As feature-length films increased in narrative, visual, and character complexity, the thrills of the serial began to look comparatively cheap or childish. And with the context of episodes 14 through 17, it's pretty easy to make inferences about other factors that led to their decline as well. As we've been seeing, movies were quickly moving out of Nickelodeons and into fancier venues, and in many places, will soon move into massive, opulent picture palaces. The often corny thrills of the serial film don't exactly fit this new kind of ultra-high-class theater exhibition. These changes in the film industry rendered the serial relatively economically unimportant. Serial films would continue to exist in theaters for decades, but would be relegated to Saturday matinee showings and would cater to children, essentially abandoned by the adult audiences who loved it just a few years earlier. With the decline of the serial film came the decline of the female action star. The likes of Pearl White were replaced with more traditional male heroes. I've seen the reasons for this described as audiences getting tired of the new woman character, and I don't know, maybe that's true, but I think a combination of plain old sexism and the serial becoming a children's genre must have had something to do with it. I think it likely that producers of serials opted to create what they felt were simpler stories, or perhaps they made stories which were more appealing to audiences which consisted of more young boys than young girls. It's hard to say because finding specific records of the demographics of movie theaters in this era is tricky, but these or other factors must have had something to do with it because movies about the new woman or the modern girl continued to be important in film across the entire world long after women were no longer commonly heroes in film serials in the United States. Along with the decline of the leading serial heroine came the decline of the stardom of Pearl White, which would not outlast the genre she was most associated with. Her last serial was released in 1924, and while she would live what sounds to me like a pretty full life, performing in other ways, owning a casino and a nightclub in Paris, and remarrying after two divorces, her time on the screen was over. The serial would continue in smaller ways throughout the sound era, but in the 1950s, the genre would find a new home on television, where you can still find it thriving today. And if this podcast was being written 25 years ago, that's where I would leave it. But in 2021, I think the spirit of the serial film is more alive now than in any time since 1920. If you look at the most popular movie franchises in the world right now, they look a lot like really big serials. Take the Star Wars movies, for example. In the 1970s and 1980s, Star Wars filmmaker George Lucas was inspired by serials when creating his own movies. That's why, until recently, each of the Star Wars films has a title that begins with an episode number, just like all of the serial adventures of Pearl White. So far, all of the Star Wars movies are directly related to the same characters or plot points. In a telling moment, I overheard a person explaining to their spouse why they were excited for the streaming show The Mandalorian. They described it this way: "It's like a new Star Wars movie every week." Surely that counts as a serial, and contributes to the serial nature of the theatrically released Star Wars films. This is even more true with the current juggernaut of the cinema, Marvel films, which require audiences to have seen all of the previous films in the series, ideally in order, to fully understand the plots of future movies. Like Star Wars, this is true now more than ever with the advent of streaming series released on a weekly schedule, which will apparently be necessary to understand the plot of future theatrically released Marvel films. In addition, both of these franchises commonly involve the action plot of heroes and villains battling over a weenie, and are even now starting to cast women as action leads. A welcome change, and one that inadvertently ties these modern series back to their serial roots from the 1910s. And that's just theatrically released films. On television, series never left, and have always been a broadcast producer's bread and butter for the very same reason that the film serials were so desirable in the Nickelodeon era. A series is easy to advertise, and very helpful when one is trying to build a program of entertainment that people will return to daily, rather than showing one high-budget, longer presentation. Streaming services do produce feature-length movies, but much of their time and attention goes into making high-prestige serials, which audiences eat up. Right now, we're living in the golden age of serials. Never before has the genre had higher budgets, more complex narratives, or better visuals. On the big screen, or on the small one. As this episode draws to a close, you may notice that I didn't talk at all about what I said we were going to cover last week. I claimed then that this episode would focus on France, and we would learn about the serials of the French filmmaker Louis Feuillade before moving on to the Italian film industry. Clearly, I didn't do that. As this week's episode developed, its narrative arc didn't have a really good place to jump across the Atlantic and describe serial films that are so dramatically different from the ones we talked about today. So, consider today's episode a hearty primer for next week's treat, as Louis Feuillade brings us into one of the first movies to simply ooze style, and bring its audience into a strange, surreal world of poisonous rings, hypnotic gazes, meaningless violence, and deadly vamps. We will journey to the criminal meeting ground known as the Howling Cat, and be introduced to the vampires. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The History of Film. My principal sources for this episode were Ben Singer's amazing section of the Oxford History of World Cinema titled Serials, and Marina Dahlquist's article on Pearl White for the Women Film Pioneers Project, produced by Columbia University. Both are spectacular resources, and I highly recommend them. This is a thought I had while writing this episode, but I also highly recommend you use the word weenie when talking about films. For one, weenie is a funny word, and I also think it has a really high utility. The director Alfred Hitchcock famously described what he called a MacGuffin as the thing that the characters on the screen worry about, but the audience don't care. A MacGuffin is the item that gets the plot moving, but what the audience cares about is the characters, not really the secret missile plans or whatever. Explaining it to other people who aren't yet familiar with the term can be a little tough sometimes, so when that happens, call it a weenie. That makes it really clear what's actually important to the audience. The Avengers have to battle Thanos and try to get all six weenies before he does. Great, I know what I'm worried about. But I digress. If you're new here, consider subscribing, and if you'd like to contact me, you can email me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit the show's website, historyoffilmpodcast.com, to view resources for this and other episodes. Thank you for listening, and join me next week for another exciting episode of The History of Film.